Molly Ivins, the liberal Texas journalist known for roasting politicians on skewers with plenty of salsa, died in Austin yesterday at the age of 62. She'd battled breast cancer since 1999. Raised in an affluent Houston neighborhood as the daughter of a Republican oil man, Ivins once said most of her strength came from learning how to stand up to her father. In the 1970s, she edited the Texas Observer, a bimonthly muckraking publication that she remained committed to all her life. She went on to work at the New York Times, but returned to Texas in the 1980s and became a syndicated columnist. She was hard on President Bush, often calling him shrub. He issued a statement yesterday saying he respected Ivins' passion and that her quick wit and commitment to her beliefs will be missed. Molly Ivins wrote 6 books, as well as pieces for Esquire, The Atlantic Monthly, and The Nation. Terry spoke to her in 2003 when her book Bushwhacked was released, 2 years and 10 months into Bush's first term in office.
Now, you're in an interesting position living in Texas and having followed George W. Bush's career as governor of that state. You write about the president's religion, and you say, while you acknowledge that, you know, religion is usually off limits for the press to write about, you think it's important to bring it up in the case of President Bush. Why?
Well, I think that George W. Bush, unlike his father, his dad, George Bush, was clearly a sort of upper-class Eastern WASP. Is really consciously, culturally identified as a Texan. And you see in his character sort of 3 common strands of Texas culture. One is religiosity, anti-intellectualism, and machismo. And all 3 of them are very appealing to broad groups of voters. And I think in Bush's case, at least with the first 2, absolutely genuine. I think the religiosity is genuine, and I think it needs to be looked at, as I say, mostly religion, pretty much, you know, you leave it out of pace. But to the extent that his religious beliefs influence policy, which they do at several intersections, then I think it's legitimate to take a look at it.
Now, in Bushwhacked, you describe the Bush administration as driven by ideology. What do you see as the ideology that drives it?
The ideology of this administration. Bush himself, as a political operator, didn't seem to me, as governor, terribly ideologically motivated. He was on some issues, death penalty, some others you couldn't move him on. But basically, he was, you know, flexible enough to play the game with the powers that then were in the legislature. And I think Bush has always chosen, you know, these older male mentors, and his pick on his way to Washington was Dick Cheney, who is really quite ideological. If you go back, political reporters are great believers in look at the record. If you check Cheney's political record as a voting member of Congress, you'll find it's really quite extraordinary. He was often one of only 1, 2, or a handful of votes opposed to what would normally be considered, you know, the legislative equivalent of voting in favor of a resolution commending motherhood. And I think that part of what has happened is that Washington is such a polarized place, and there genuinely is the people who call themselves movement conservatives who really genuinely subscribe to the ideology that government is bad, the marketplace will solve all problems, we're much better off, you know, with unfettered capitalism, no government, just let the marketplace solve everything. And that, I think that's almost like a religious belief rather than a political belief. It seems to be an article of faith with many of these people. Undeterred by reality, experience, the record, or anything else. And so it seems to me that Bush has actually become more ideological since he's gone to Washington, particularly to the extent that he, and this is a really elementary political mistake, I can't believe Karl Rove, who's a very smart guy, is really letting this happen. It seems to me the mistake is that they're only listening to one another, that there is a sort of loop of insiders, and I mentioned Rumsfeld and Cheney, and all that circle of people, they're just talking to each other, and they're not hearing from anyone outside the circle, which is always a fatal mistake.
Molly Ivins speaking with Terry Gross in 2003. Ivins died yesterday at the age of 62. Her first interview on Fresh Air was in 1991, when her book, Molly Ivins Can't Say That, Can She?, was published. She began with a reading from the book.
In my youth, I aspired to be a great journalist. George Orwell, Albert Camus, and I.F. Stone were my heroes, great writers and intellectuals who helped illuminate their times. But look, God gave those guys fascism, communism, colonialism, and McCarthyism to struggle against. All I got was Lubbock. It's not my fault.
do you still feel like you didn't get the big stories to cover?
I'm afraid so, although I must say there's enough real about the great state of Texas to keep anybody busy.
Well, it seems to me what your stories have turned out to be is Texas, women, and general overall stupidity in politics.
I've been writing about Texas politics for a long time, and that will give a person plenty of material.
You've written that as a lifelong Texas liberal, you've spent your whole life, your whole of your existence, in a political climate to the right of Ronald Reagan. You're, in fact, from a family who was very right-wing. What was right-wing about them?
Well, my daddy was John Connally's campaign manager. I guess that qualifies.
All right.
I have to say, my daddy and I don't agree on much politically. In fact, it's true. I'm about the political climate of Texas and what I think of as most of the real world. I define the real world as just about every place outside Manhattan Island. It has always sort of amazed and amused me that so many of these right-wing intellectuals, that they call the neoconservatives, seem to be operating under the bizarre impression that the world is actually run by people of the liberal persuasion, a notion I find so comical that I'm barely able to talk politics with those folks.
What got you questioning the conservative worldview that your family had?
Well, I think all Southern liberals come from the same starting point, which is race. I grew up in the South before the Civil Rights Movement, and it was an era when all grown-ups lied. If you lived in the white part of town and you'd go to the drinking fountains, they'd say, now, don't drink out of that fountain, dear. That's dirty. That was the one that said colored on it. Well, of course, you lived in the white part of town and kids had been crawling all over the white fountain all day. It was full of bubble gum and dirty grease marks and stuff. And you knew that the colored fountain wasn't dirty. There was something they weren't telling you. And you know how horribly logical little children can be. You just start picking up on those clues early on, and somehow I never got over it. The first great political question when I was coming up was civil rights, and I was in favor of it. And the second great political question to come along was the war in Vietnam, and I was against it. So people told me that meant I was some kind of double-dyed, full-blooded liberal. I said, okay, what did I know? Later on, people took to claiming that it meant I was in favor of big government and communism and high taxes. And that's when I figured out that I should never let anybody else define my politics.
Was your family prosperous? Were you a debutante? Did you have a coming-out party?
No, I was not myself a debutante, but I went to debutante parties. I suppose to some extent did grow up in rather a privileged world. I went to a private school in Houston, Texas, and later went on to Smith College and Columbia University. The flavor of my political opinions, I think, comes not from... In part, I think I grew up different from other girls of my background simply because I read a great deal. And I suppose there was an additional factor. I'm almost 6 feet tall, which makes it hard to be a sweet, dainty, pretty, feminine, little, sweet, proper Southern belle. I mean, they made me captain of the basketball team when I was 4, and that sort of went like that.
When did you start writing about the legislature, the Texas legislature, and what was your early response to it?
My first session was in 1971, and I walked onto the floor of the Texas House of Representatives, and it looked sort of like the first day of school. There were 150 men all slapping each other on the back and patting each other on the butt and meeting and greeting and carrying on, and I saw one old boy dig another old boy in the ribs with his elbow and say, hey, fella, You should see what I found myself last night. And she don't talk neither. And the two of them went off shortly and snuckling. And I just thought to myself, you know, this is fabulous. It makes some people kind of sick, but very from the beginning, I just thought, this is reporter heaven. This is too funny to be believed, and I've been writing about it that way ever since.
It's good that you were able to keep your bearings and think that you were sane and they were crazy. Not everybody thrown into such a situation would be able to maintain their bearings.
Oh, if you had ever witnessed that collection of geeks and dorks and bozos we have in the state legislature of Texas, I don't think you'd have much trouble.
Do you think that the Texas legislature is any worse than any other states?
Certainly, we're number one bad, and I'll fight to the death with anybody who says we're not. Actually, I do have to tell you, of course, there's great politics over our neighboring state of Louisiana. And in a political storytelling contest, I often get a run for my money with folks from New Jersey and Illinois. But I have been in political storytelling contests all over this country with my fellow political writers, and I've never lost one. All I have to do is keep telling true stories about the Texas legislature, and sooner or later they all give up and say uncle.
Can you tell one of your favorites for us?
Well, there's so many it's hard to say, but perhaps my all-time favorite Texas representative was Mike Martin from Longview. He was an early harbinger of the moral majority. Got elected on a platform of being pro-family and pro-American, but frankly, if you'd put that man's brain in a bumblebee, it would have flown backwards. He could not get a single bill passed, not even memorial resolutions for people in his district who had died. So when it came time for re-election, of course, kind of hard to get re-elected if you hadn't done anything. Looked bad for Mike's re-election chances, but he came up with an innovative scheme. He paid his cousin Charlie to shoot him in the arm with a shotgun. Then he claimed it had been done by a satanic and communistic cult. And here were the law enforcement people running all over Texas trying to find some satanic communistic cult, which is fairly hard to do. And there was great uproar in the press about it, and everybody running around thinking people, the lives of legislators were in danger, and nobody knew what to think about it. Well, the plot came unraveled. Charlie had too much beer, as I recall, in a bar one night and spilled the beans. And I always point out, only the Texas legislature would have had the foresight to make it illegal to pay someone to shoot you. It is illegal in our state, so don't come down and do it, Terry. And with that, Mike Martin became a wanted man. But instead of facing up to his then legal difficulties, Mike Martin took it on the lam. He went underground. He went into hiding. And we had to send the Texas Rangers after him. They hunted him high, hunted him low. Took him 2 weeks to track Martin to earth. He was hidden at his mother's house outside Longview. And they actually found him hiding in the stereo cabinet. Now, many people have asked me what Martin was doing in that stereo cabinet. I'm here to tell you that man always did want to be a speaker.
The title of your new book, Molly Ivins Can't Say That, Can She?, comes from an actual story. Would you tell the story?
When I first started writing a column for the Dallas Times Herald back in 1982, I found Dallas, Texas to be really quite a buttoned-up sort of town, really very proper. And they were not used to someone with my kind of freewheeling style. And I reviewed the performance of a local congressman. He was a Republican from North Dallas, and took a look at what he'd done lately, and it caused me to render the judgment that if that man's IQ slipped any lower, we'd have to water him twice a day. Well, that, good heavens, touched off all kinds of outraged protest from Republicans around there, and they all threatened to cancel their subscriptions and start advertiser boycotts and such, and my paper did kind of a gutsy thing. They took out billboards all over Dallas, Texas that said, Molly Ivins can't say that, can she?
And what effect did that advertising campaign have? How did it go over?
Well, it's been real interesting. Every year they do polls to see who is the best liked and most hated columnist in Dallas, and I'm always both of them. So we figure that means people are reading it.
That's great. Now, is it right that the New York Times fired you for describing a community chicken-killing festival as a gang pluck?
That comes close to truth. I actually,
how close?
I resigned from the Times, but I was not in good smell with the powers that be, and it was over the time I tried to call that community chicken killing a gang pluck. They felt that was conduct unbecoming a New York Times reporter.
And how did they let you know that?
Oh, I had this hilarious interview with Abe Rosenthal, then the executive editor of the Times. I had been Rocky Mountain bureau chief for the New York Times for 3 years, covered 9 mountain states out in, from the Canadian to the Mexican border. It was a wonderful assignment. And that's where I wrote the story about the community chicken slaughter. And when I got back to New York, I was abruptly recalled, kind of like a defective automobile. Abe hauled me into his office, and we kind of went around about whether or not I was deliberately trying to stick my thumb in the eye of the New York Times, as I recall his words. And I explained that, no, I never tried to do that, actually. I just never understood where they drew the line at the Times. And when it was pointed out to me, my honest reaction was always, you've got to be kidding. So we argued that up and down a bit, and then he said in an accusatory tone, you tried to call that community chicken killing a gang pluck. I said, yes, Abe, I did. He said, gang pluck. I said, well, Abe, I thought it was a good line. He said, gang pluck. I said, hey, well, Abe, it's a play on words. He said, gang pluck. You were trying, that is a play on gang f-. You were trying to make our readers think of the word f-. I said, damn, Abe, you are a hard man to fool.
I'm wondering, you know, some people from Texas end up telling stories about their state and everything. Do you think that some people camp it up a little bit when telling colorful stories about the South?
Yes and no. There's a genre of person that we refer to somewhat scornfully as professional Texans. I must say sometimes I feel in danger of becoming a professional Texan myself. And people who, you know, have lived up here in the North and who dine out on old stories for many years, eventually becoming terrible bores to everyone, including themselves. There is an almost irresistible tendency to play Texan, however. I remember when I first joined the Times, the editors were taking me around and they'd introduce me to someone and say, this is Molly Ivan, she just joined the paper, she's from Texas. And people would look up very expectantly and say, oh, from Texas? And I found myself sticking out my hand and saying, howdy. You know, I just didn't want to let anybody down.
Right.
And there is an extent to which you play the role, particularly if you're a Texan in the North, because people expect it of you and enjoy it. And sometimes I feel when I'm in the North as though I speak two languages and they only speak one.
But you speak North and South?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In Texas circles, do you ever end up at parties with some of the politicians who you cover?
Yes, I do. I have always been something of an outsider journalist because my political opinions aren't popular in my home state. Yes, I have over the years socialized with Texas politicians.
Does that make it harder to say what you want to say about them?
Not for me.
Do you ever learn anything that gives you insights into their character or politics from the parties?
I'm trying to think. Yes, I suppose so. Although, as a journalist, stuff that you learn that you can't use really isn't that much use to you.
I bet you see a lot of stuff that you can't use at those parties.
Yeah, but I don't, I have, you know, I love to make fun of politicians, and as far as I'm concerned, they're all in a free fire zone. But I do have some respect for their privacy. Even the dimmest of them actually devote a fair number of hours to public service, and I think they deserve some respect for their privacy.
Molly Ivins, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
All right. It was my pleasure.
Molly Ivins speaking with Terry Gross in 1991. Ivins died in Austin yesterday at the age of 62.